Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. Welcome, my friends, to another episode of Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Today, we are joined by Rabbi Elie Fisher, and we are going to be exploring perhaps one of the most iconic and radical tshuvos of the Rush. Yes, it is the one about Vesein Tal Matar, and with Pesach rapidly approaching, I'm sorry if I have to inform you, Pesach is rapidly approaching. This is, of course, in Yana Diyoma and very relevant. But before we jump into the tshuva, in case you might not be familiar, Rabbi Elie Fisher is an independent writer, translator, and rabbi. Previously, he was the JLIC rabbi and campus educator at the University of Maryland. He holds a BA and MS degrees from Yeshiva University, rabbinical ordination from Israel's chief rabbinate, and is working toward a doctorate in Jewish history at Tel Aviv University. He is the founding editor of The Lairhouse, a web magazine of contemporary Jewish thought. His original writing has appeared in numerous Jewish publications. Among the issues he writes about are religion and politics in Israel, the interplay between legal and non-legal elements of the Talmud, Jewish religious culture, and Central European Jewish history. He is editor of Rabbi Eliezer Melamed's Penine Halacha series in English and co-founder of Hamapa, a project that applies quantitative analysis to rabbinic literature. Originally from Baltimore, he currently resides in Modi'in, Israel, with his wife and four children. Rabbi Elie Fisher has you have quite a reputation for being an expert and passionate about Shalos and Tshuvos. I love getting people on here who share that passion and also know more than I do. So it's a genuine privilege to have you with us today. I believe our listeners are in for a treat. And okay, before we jump into the Tshuva of the Rush, this is the first Tshuva of the Rush we're doing, so maybe just give us, like in 1 minute, a very brief profile for our listeners, for myself, who was the Rush, and what is the context of this Tshuva we're about to jump into?
Okay, so the Rush is really one of the greatest of the Rishonim. He lived in the sort of the turn of the 14th century, the late 13th, early 14th century. He was one of the primary students of Maharami Rutenberg, right? Mayor of Rothenburg. And so he is, Rothenburg was the greatest of the Ashkenazi sages of his generation in the tail end of the 1200s, famously died in prison. The Rosh, you know, seeing what happens, he fled. Some of his contemporaries and colleagues, like the Mordechai and the author of Hagaos Maimonios, were not as lucky. They were actually killed. The Rosh fled first to Provence and then to Spain. And most of his rabbinic career is in Spain. He's a younger contemporary of the Rashba, with whom he met. And his son, you know, because he was an Ashkenazi who was transplanted into Sfarad, you know, his son, Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Asher, ends up creating this halachic code, which sort of draws on both Ashkenazic and Sephardic halachic traditions.
I think I may have heard of it, possibly.
You may have heard of it, possibly. It's called the Tor, the Arba Turim. And so the Rosh is really, he's sort of like almost like a drainage basin. He like everything is coming, like he's on one hand, he's at the tail end of the Tosafist school. He is one of the Balei HaTosfos. We have his Tosfos. We have the Tosfos HaRosh. You know, in a sense, you can say that he hit the trifecta. We have Tosfos that he wrote. We have Tshuvos that he wrote. And he wrote a monumental commentary based on the Rif, meaning it's on all of Shas, but basically everything that the Rif writes on. And once again, because when he gets to Spain, everybody's using the Rif. He has his Ashkenazic tradition, and so he's building his halachic commentary or quasi code on the Rif. You know, so really, like, we don't have very many people who wrote. They wrote Tosfos, and they wrote a large number of responsa. Meaning, he amongst the Rishonim, he's overshadowed by his two contemporaries, the Rashba and Maharami Rutenberg, who wrote more tshuvas than anybody else in the period of the Rishonim, and it's not close. Meaning they were like, you know, when Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs in a season and like everybody else was hitting in the low 20s, it wasn't close. They were just so they were just writing so many more tubas than anybody else.
Right. To illustrate, then, I mean, most people are listening, they won't see, but I have the Machon Yerushalayim Tshuva Sarash in front of me. It's a single volume. The Rashba, I think it's like a 5 to 7 volume, depending how you count it. So the Rashba is pretty immense. But the Rush is no slouch either.
No, that's what I'm saying. The Rush is no slouch. It's like, it's just when it comes to, and he did a lot of other things. Now, the truth of the matter is, so did the Rashba, right? The Rashba also wrote Torah Sabayis. The Rashba wrote a commentary on Shas, right? We're talking about people, these are no one-trick ponies here.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
These are some of the greatest sages of our tradition.
Well, you don't become a pillar of halacha for nothing. And so this is what really, I think, fascinates me about this tshuva, is because, I don't know, if I was living somewhere and the Rush Paskin to do X, Y, and Z, if you would say jump, I would ask how high. Yet what we're about to look at is a tshuva in which the Rush, he Paskins a shayla, and people are like, we're not going to accept it. So maybe just transitioning into the particular scenario over here, I'm just looking, at least in my edition, I'm not sure in the edition you have, but in the Machon Yerushalayim, at least, they have a prelude. There is this little exposition before the actual tshuva begins, which appears to be, I think, maybe written by his posterity, and they're describing how he was like sitting one day and he was contemplating the questions about V'Sein Ta'amater and Mashiv HaRuach. And then next paragraph, there's the actual tshuva.
No, there's not an actual tshuva. Look at, even if you see it in the first lines,
right.
And this is, I chose this tshuva for a number of reasons. You see a lot of really interesting features of response as well. Meaning our assumption when we come in is like, okay, a tshuva is somebody asked a question and somebody wrote an answer, and then they collected the questions and answers and published them into a manuscript or into a printed book. And then you have a Sefer Shelos and Tshuvos, but that's not really what happens, is it? This is written as a story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story.
Yeah.
And it's not written by the Rush. It's written by his son.
Right.
We don't know which son. The Rush had a number of sons. But this was written by his son. We could read the first few lines, right? In the year 5073, right? So that's 50, quick math, right? 1313 from the creation of the world. This is the year 1313. There was no rain, right? There was only a little bit of, there was a famine in Spain. And they called a fast to beg God to give rains. And then you see, like, the way that it's described, Vayibalel Rishon Shel Pesach was the first night of Pesach after Mariv. Adoni Ovia Rav Zal Yoshev Al Petach Bezel. The Rav was like, he was sitting on his front porch, literally sitting on his front porch. And a bunch of guys, like, he was holding forth, right? The Rav is sitting on his front porch, and some of the younger guys, like his sons and some of the other students, are hanging out. And he says, this is a good opportunity to bring up something that I've been meaning to get to bring up. And it's something that's frustrated me my entire career, because it's something that I really think is true. And I tried to make change when I lived in Germany and nobody listened to me. And I tried to make change when I lived in Provence and nobody listened to me. And I tried to do it here also and nobody listens to me. What is it that nobody's listening about, right? So we know that the Gemara in Ta'anit talks about, what's called She'elat Geshamim, right? During a certain part of the year, the rainy season, we pray for rain. And I'm not talking about saying Mashiv HaRuach, which is what's called Gevurot Geshamim, mentioning, invoking God's power through provision of rain, but She'elat Geshamim, actually asking God, please make it rain, right? And the way that we say that in the Ashkenazi liturgy is we either say, in the non-rainy season, we say, v'tein bracha al p'nei ha'adama. And in the rainy season, we say, v'tein tal u'matar livracha al p'nei ha'adama. Bring dew and rain for prosperity over the land, okay? Now, most of your audience, I assume, live in that really large part of the world called Chutz La'aretz,
We actually, according to analytics, I think about 15% of listeners are in Eretz Yisrael, by the way. But okay. Yes, many are in Chutz La'aretz.
Okay.
So, shout out to all of our Israeli listeners.
Okay, so there's a difference in custom between Israel and outside. In Israel, the rainy season is starts earlier, so we start saying V'tein Talu Matar Livracha 2 weeks after Sukkot on the 7th of or the night of the 7th of Cheshvan, the night of the 8th of Cheshvan. I don't remember when, but you know, I rely on the Gabbai to flop and tell me.
But I see you haven't taken on the Minhag Olam in the modern Orthodox world to call it Mar Cheshvan.
Oh, whatever.
I'm just messing.
Old habits die hard. It's fine. It is Mar Cheshvan. I mean, that's the name.
Yes.
If I'm preparing a ksuba, it'll be Mar Cheshvan. Okay. I can say Cheshvan. In Chutz La'aretz, it started out that this was the custom in Babylonia, but that actually was later expanded to include anywhere in Chutz La'aretz. We go from what's now December 4th or 5th or 6th until Pesach, until the beginning of Pesach. Now, how do we get to the 4th or 5th or the 6th? That's a whole other question.
Yes.
We actually have never, the halacha has never accounted for the Gregorian shift. So if you open up the Rishonim and they're talking about starting to make the change on the 22nd of November, and you're like, wait, how do we get to the December 5th? Because we haven't accounted for the Gregorian shift. And so now we're talking about a difference of about 13 or 14 days, give or take.
Be it as it may, there seems to be a radical difference between Eretz Yisrael versus Bavel and or / Chutz La'aretz, depending if we put them all in one classification, which is what
well,
the
that's
Rush
exactly the issue that the Rush is dealing with, right? In Bavel, where most of the irrigation, they didn't rely on rainwater to grow the plants, because you have those two major mighty rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, that go through. So the rain, the important rain, is the rain that falls on the Caucasus Mountains, right? Or on the way far to the north of where the Jews lived, right? We need to make sure that there's water in the river, right? So it's not the connection between the rains and the produce growing are not as immediate. In Eretz Yisrael, where we don't have these kinds of rivers, we need to rely on the rains much more. So we start davening for rain much earlier. Now along comes the Rush and says, this really shouldn't depend on, and he's absolutely right. Right? I mean, it's not really a question that he's about whether or not he's right. Clearly makes sense, right? And it's the Rush, right? He comes along and says, this really shouldn't depend on custom. It should depend on climate. Meaning, if you live in a climate where things are more like the climate of Eretz Yisrael, then you should follow the practice in Eretz Yisrael. And when he's in Provence is on the Mediterranean. It has a similar climate to Eretz Yisrael. When he's in Spain, right? If you're in Catalonia, I don't remember exactly where he was. He moved around a little bit in Spain, but the areas in Spain which were most heavily Jewish in the time of the Rush were the areas of what's today Catalonia, which also has a Mediterranean climate. And the Rush is saying, like, it makes most sense for us to do what they do in Eretz Yisrael. And he actually says, he says that that's what you should do, but right. He also says, I tried. Nobody listened.
Right. So if I may, I just wanted to read, there's a formulation that really, I thought really encapsulated very well. He writes this again toward the beginning of, I know we mentioned, it says, "Vayichtom Megillah Sefer L'chazik Dvar V'zeh Tarfa," that we're getting a synopsis of the actual discussion. But he writes, or the son writes, the Talmud Bavel Chashvinan Iker, that even though we generally follow the Talmud Bavli, Hani Mili Bedover Isser Veheter Vechiv Ptor Tumo Tuhara, when it comes to these kind of more ritual kind of questions, Avodover Hatoi Betzorech Hashab, but something which is context dependent, Ve'embo shinoi lavor al divrei Torah roi leilich acher hashanim b'makomos v'azman. There are certain things which are just simply based on the makom that you are found in. And he's saying is this isn't an attack on the halachic system or halachic formalism. It just simply, this isn't like an itzer beheter question. It's simply that we have a mandate to say this prayer of Saint Talmater when it is appropriate for the given region that we find ourselves in. And yet, as you point out, Rabbi Fisher, for some reason, people were not persuaded by what seems, I think, I don't want to speak for you, but to me, a rather compelling argument.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting. If you fast forward a couple of hundred years, right, the Rush writes this in the year 1313, a little less than 200 years later, this fellow, you know, white Europeans discover America. And it doesn't take too long before there are Jewish colonies in the New World. And in the Southern Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And obviously we know that in the Southern Hemisphere, the seasons are reversed from the Northern Hemisphere. Right. So there, right, the rainy season and the dry season, if for in Israel, for example, the rainy season goes from approximately October until April, and then the dry season goes from April until October, then everything is reversed in Australia and in South Africa and in Argentina. So there, it would, if you're going to follow the Rush's logic, it should be completely reversed. It should be completely inverted, okay? And these were the questions, the first questions that came from the New World, the first halachic questions that we have that were written to, it was written to Brazil, mm-hmm. And it was the tshuva was written by Rabbi Chaim Shabtai, who was a rav in Salonika in the early part of the 1600s. Mm-hmm. He's asked this question, and he basically says, like, look, in theory, you should be reversing it. But the Rush already had a tshuva. He couldn't get anybody to make any changes. Who am I? You should just say, you know, you should daven for rain in Shema Kolenu, where you can, it's freestyle. You can add whatever you want into the tefillah. You don't have to wait for, but to change the text of the Shemona Esrei itself, the fixed text of saying whether you say the same bracha or the same talumata bracha, that we don't play with.
So this is interesting. And I appreciate you getting to like kind of like the reception here, which is the applicability of the Rush. It's not just simply to when there's a difference in days or months between Eretz Yisrael and maybe Europe, but when we get to the Southern Hemisphere, I mean, this question becomes especially important because the implications are far more radical. But even before we get to that, I think the Rush, somewhere in the Tshuva, he mentions that Kishiyatsasi me Ashkenaz, and right, and you said he made his way around, yes, Provence. He did encounter a community, from what I understand, that sort of like halfway adopted him on when they started with Saint Talmatar, but they didn't want to extend it from Pesach to Shavuos. And when he asks them, well, why not? They kind of shrug and they say, this is just the minhag that we've had. I don't know why we do it halfway. We start earlier, but we're not willing to go later, even though their region needed it. So we're kind of finding people who, you know, they thought about this before the Rush visited their community. But we even see people who are, someone told us to make a change early on, but they're not being consistent. Because if you're consistent, you should be able to change the start and the end date for the very same reason, right?
Right. Yeah, he says that Be'ashkenaz Iker Kiyum HaTfuah Hi Al Yedei HaGeshamim Shebein Pesach La'atzeres, right? That the most important rains of the year in Ashkenaz, which is when he talks about Ashkenaz, he's talking specifically about the Rhineland, is the rain that falls between Pesach and Shavuos. So he wanted to extend the period of when you say the same Talmud Matar until Shavuos, but like you said, they didn't do that. Now, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of times we'll talk about, the what you call the Chadash Asar Min HaTorah approach, that we don't change anything. And this is actually a good example of something that has had an incredible amount of tenacity, right? Where and we mentioned earlier the whole Maariv on December 5th thing or December 6th. I mean, that's even more tenacious, right? Meaning the Gregorian shift for, you know, just to give a to give like the 30-second background, a day. Okay, the Gemara says that in Bavel they start at praying for rain 60 days after the Yom HaTkufa, right? Which is like the day that the season changes, which is the day of the autumnal equinox. So 60 days after the autumnal equinox is when we would start praying for rain. Now, for over 1,000 years, the Christian world was on what's called the Julian calendar that was devised during the time of Julius Caesar, and it calculated a year to be exactly 365.25 days. Now, in reality, a year, an astronomical year, is a little bit less than that. A few minutes a year, but a few minutes a year adds up over the centuries. So by the time you got to the 1600s, I believe it was, maybe the 1500s, there was the day that was supposed to be the autumnal equinox was supposed to be on September 21st or 22nd or something like that. It had already slid into the beginning of October. So under Pope Gregory, the Catholic Church changed the calendar system to what we have today, meaning it took away three leap years every 400 years. I.e., they took away, they years that are multiples of 100 are not leap years, except for years that are multiples of 400, which are leap years. So 2000 was a leap year, but 1900 was not a leap year, even though they're both multiples of four.
You know, okay. all my trauma from Sukkah, what was it, Daf Ches or something there with pi? You're bringing back all that trauma spinning around in my head right now.
Okay.
If you're a listener and you're not a math person, imo nohi bitzara. But I appreciate Rabbi Fisher that you could explicate it.
No, but here's the kicker. Here's what happened. Pope Gregory, because he was the Pope and because he could paskin and people would have to listen to him, he said, in order to bring things back to where they were, he didn't just say, like, from now on, we're going to change the calendar. He said, okay, we overshot the mark by, it was at that point, 10 or 11 days. We're dropping those days. Everybody's going to sleep today on October 5th, and we're waking up tomorrow on October 16th. 10 days are just deleted from the calendar. Okay, but we're not Catholics, right? We never deleted those days from the calendar. And we also didn't change the way that we calculate things. So we're still basically, we still base when this happens on a calendar of exactly 365.25 days. And so every 400 years or so, when we begin asking for rain, slides deeper and deeper into the winter, right? So now it's at December 5th or 6th.
When are we due for our next one?
In the year 2100. In the year 2100, it'll shift forward a day.
You're saying that Art Scroll and Corin are going to have to I guess it's a good marketing strategy, right? They're going to have to make a new printing. It can't just say December 4th and 5th at the St. Talmudter anymore. It works out really well for Big Sitter.
Yeah, so if we're all still around in the year 2099, and one of the printers of Sidurim, you know, comes out with like a big deal, like a big, you know, a clearance sale on Sidurim that they're selling them for, you know, pennies on the dollar. If you're around then in the 76 years, you'll know why they're doing that. You'll know why they're doing that. May we all still be around then. Although by then we might all be in Eretz Yisrael, and if we're all in Eretz Yisrael, then we just do it based on Cheshvan, not based on December or whatever.
So then it's Lidrosh L'Kabel Schar.
Lidrosh L'Kabel Schar. Oh, and this is definitely Lidrosh L'Kabel Schar. And it's also interesting, like, you know, there's a school of halacha that calls itself like the positive historicist school. Mm-hmm. It's associated with certain strains within the conservative movement, but like the old conservative movement. And that's one of the things that they did to like distinguish itself from like Orthodox halacha. And so like, for a while I had a number of students who were, studying in students and friends who were studying in conservative rabbinical school, and I was like very excited. I was like, when do you guys start saying the St. Talmud Matar? Because I was like waiting for somebody to say that, like, oh yeah, we start on like, you know, November 22nd, like based on, you know, because we recalculated the Gregorian shift, but nobody has, right?
Sorry, so, just for a moment for myself and for listeners not familiar. So what exactly is the definition of the positive historical approach?
It's Kitzer. There's no one definition, but what it is it's one that's much more inclined to, you know, to Paskin based on empirical scientific evidence, right? One, you know, it could be something like, you know, like Tchelet is an example of positive historical halacha, and that's something that's entirely within the, you know, within the, I think that Tchelet is a phenomenon that exists almost entirely within the Orthodox world. So like you do have different, you know, you have different amongst Poskim, you have some that are more empirical and so, empiricist, some that are more textual, some that are more traditionalist. And I think that those are like three of the nodes
the definition of death debate, you know, with Rabbi Rosh Hashanah, Rabbi Bleich, that one, that's a great example. Do you go based on the reading? Do you include the liver? Do you look at brain death just empirically? That maybe that's a good litmus test, if you will.
There are a number of the international dateline question is an interesting one that comes up in this respect. There are a bunch. Pretty much like there's every area of halacha is going to have some sorts of, you know, questions like this. Especially, yeah, you know, anything that touches on medicine.
Oh, of course. Right. Because that's constantly developing. If I may, just because I know we're drawing close to a close, at the conclusion of the tshuva, there's a few really interesting points, really right at the last paragraph. He says, when I saw Barosiki hitu es lev hakahal lebilti kibol mimeni divrei elokim chayim, they didn't want to accept my words of the living God. Gam ani chazarti bi milisho lahaskir beisak nezesheni mispalabo. I myself conformed to the normative practice, which was not in accordance with my own opinion. Because this is for the community. And he's So it's like he invokes losis godidu and says, though I have an opinion on this, I feel strongly about it, it's been bothering me all my life, no matter where I've been, I'm still going to conform to the normative practice of the community. I think that's
and then
quite
he
remarkable.
Says that I feel so strongly about this that I permitted myself to write this on Chol Hamoed.
Yes.
I mean, he started off, I mean, the story begins on Leil HaSeder, right. And he says, you know what, I feel strongly enough about this that I'm gonna write this on Chol Hamoed. And we know that writing on Chol Hamoed is not a simple question. He says, I think it's necessary because, you know, there are going to be fights in the community because people know what I said. And so that there's no Chilul Hashem, I'm writing on Chol Hamoed.
Right. He says, right. So Mipnei Chol Shem Shemayim. And also he says, it's a Kitzas Tzorech Hamoed. You know, it is a Tzorech for the Chol Hamoed. People do need to know what the conclusion of the
what
matter
to daven
is.
What's on Chol Hamoed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
like,
pretty
important. To prevent this on Chol Hamoed itself. Right. Yeah.
And this is before we all could just, you know, circumvent the issues of writing by simply typing on computers, assuming you hold that's okay. This last line here, I think is absolutely remarkable that the Rush himself, and this is the thing, you know, I remember seeing this on, the Minchas Chinuch on Achri Rabban Lahatos talks about how Shammai was able to still maintain their own practices, even though Basil was the majority, because a Talmud Chacham is entitled to an opinion and to practice based on his reading of the Sugya. But here the Rush was concerned for the integrity of the community, and he was willing to take one for the team, it would seem.
Yeah, I think that it's an important thing, and it's also important because, like, you know, this is, I mean, look, I think part of what's implied by what the Rush is saying is, like, when I daven, I'm not davening for myself, I'm davening on behalf of the community. So maybe in another area of halacha, I might permit myself to do my own thing and not necessarily do the same thing that the community is trying to do. But here, because this thing is so public and because we're davening to God for the needs of the community should be all together in this.
Right. A community-based mitzvah should have a unified communal approach. That does make sense. And that, I believe, is what he's saying that makes this unique. So are there any, just, you know, in conclusion, Rabbi Fisher, are there any other interesting takeaways or observations that you have about the tshuva that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah. So I think that it's a great example of what shaylos and tshuvos are and what they're not. Right? We tend to think of, you know, shaylos and tshuvos as verdicts. These are rabbinic, you know, these are like rabbinic fiat. You ask the rabbi and the rabbi says, this is what needs to be done. And you see from here that that's really not how it happens, right? That the way that halacha develops is, you know, through a system of trust and through a system of, let's say, you know, like anybody that asks a shaila, and historically in shaylos u'tshuvos, it's usually rabbis who ask the shailas. The rabbi gets to choose when to ask a shaila. The rabbi gets to choose who to ask the shaila to, right? So in that way, it's very much what we would call emergent. It's not entirely ground up, because the questions are coming from the professional class, from the rabbis themselves, but it is bottom up, because the, you know, it's not that Rav Moshe Feinstein decided that everybody was going to ask him shailas. It's that everybody decided that they were going to ask Rav Moshe Feinstein questions. It's not that everybody decided, you know, that the rush imposed himself on everyone else. It's that everybody decided the rush is the guy that we're going to ask our shailas to. And this sort of, it sort of flies in the face of how we think about rabbinic authority and how authority is constructed, because here's the one example where the rush doesn't get his way. Even though he makes perfect sense, they trusted him with life and death questions, literal life and death questions, meaning there are questions in the rush where he talks about, putting people to death and whether or not it's permitted to put people to death. And people asked him those shailas, and presumably they put the person to death on the Rav's word, on the Rosh's word. But here he's saying, yeah, we should probably change these two words in davening. And people are like, no way. I don't care if you're the smartest rabbi in the world. We are not changing those two words in davening. I don't care how much sense it makes. We are not changing those two words in davening. This says so much about how halacha actually works.
And it's how people work also. I mean, I work in a shul and I have a lot of wonderful, lovely congregants. I need to make sure that's clear for all my wonderful congregants who are listening.
Here it comes.
There you go. Yeah, here it comes. But I've met so many people in my lifetime who, like, they couldn't care as much for something like Shabbos, which you violate Shabbos back in the good old days. It carries capital punishment. But when it comes to, like, oh, we always use that particular tune for Berchos Kohanim when we duchen Dan Yontif, how can we now change that? I'm like, this isn't even a halachic question, but it's amazing. Like, here we see in the rush, when he tried changing the custom of the community, he said, no, this is how my father did it. This is how my grandfather did it. And, you know, I'll tell you something. There may even be a mila to that. Rabbi Norman Lam, I'm putting together all my Haggadah verts right now. So in the Rabbi Norman Lam Haggadah, he quotes the Ora Chaim, the classic Ora Chaim, who says that during the Spanish Inquisition, it was all of the intellectuals who converted, and it was those with emuna pshuta who were able to maintain the Mesorah, even if they did not understand all the halakhic intricacies of why they did it. But, you know, and Ayin Dr. Soloveitchik as well, I'm sure, on that. But those were the people who ultimately secured the integrity and continuity of our tradition. So, you know, on the one hand, I joke about it and it frustrates me. And on the other hand, maybe these kind of people who are super resistant to change are the people who ensure that we actually are able to maintain our Mesorah from one generation to the next.
Yeah. And I think I would go further than that. I think that there are, listen, change in halacha, change in Mesorah happens all the time, right? If your listener, whoever your listener is, I can almost guarantee that your listener's grandparents or great grandparents didn't say Parshas Haman on Tuesday of Parshas B'Shalach, and, you know, didn't say the Tefillah Seshlah on whatever it is, Beis Sivan. There are all kinds of practices we're constantly taking on new practices. Certainly didn't, you know, say Halal on Yom HaAtzmaut for the segment of the community for whom that's now a tradition.
Is that a chumrah or a kula?
These things are changing. These things are changing. There are things that are changing all the time, mm-hmm. constantly. Okay. The question is, where are the things, like, when does it encounter resistance? When does halachic change encounter resistance? And it could be that the same people who are resistant with regard to one thing are completely, you know, flexible when it comes to something else. And that says a lot about them, right? Meaning, as my friend Chaim Seyman likes to say, it's like, if you're completely flexible when it comes to halacha, except for when it comes to halacha pertaining to women, then you might be a misogynist, right? It was like, if that's the only thing that you're really frum about, then it doesn't have anything to do with frumkeit. It's got to be something else, right? So, and I'm not saying, like, you know, this is something, right? When it comes to saying v'sein talu matar, you have to ask yourself, what's really the cost, right? On one hand, it's not a big change. On the other hand, what's really pushing us to change? It's not, there's nothing, right? There's no financial, there's no moral dilemma that's, you know, that's causing us to train, that's the impetus for this halachic change. The halachic change is coming from, you know, as we talked about before, impetus for halachic change is coming from math, basically, right? It's like, that's not a great reason for halachic change, okay? So it's like, it's not a major change, but it's also, it's not a great reason for change.
Not so exciting.
And I think that that's something that we need to think about a little bit more. And it's something that I, you know, Chaim Seyman and I are actually thinking about writing a book on this. It's like, it's the question of, does halacha change or does halacha not change, is not very interesting. The question of when and how it changes, right? And how come you have that in some cases there's change and in some cases there's like fierce resistance to change amongst the same people. That's what's interesting.
That is indeed Yeah, that is a very fascinating question, which is, we know certain halachas are more likely to change than others, but can we identify trends as to why certain ones meet resistance, why certain ones change? And so Rabbi Fisher, I think what you've, you know, really demonstrated for our listeners, for myself, and, you know, really the reason why the Shalos or Tshuvas genre is so fascinating for me, and I think for many, is because it's really at that crossroads of the halacha and the sociology of what the Jewish people have faced throughout the years. So Rabbi Fisher, I look forward, God willing, to that work that you referenced. Our listeners should be aware that Rabbi Fisher has an excellent podcast, Down the Rabbi Hole. He analyzes Shalos and Tshuvos as well as, I'm sure, many other lovely things there as well. And Rabbi Fisher, thank you so much for sharing your time and wisdom with us here today. And God willing, looking forward to learning from you again once more.
Thank you. One last thing. If you do post in the show's notes, if you do post the Sefaria translation, it is something that I translated about 10 years ago. I did a project for Sefaria. I translated about 40 or 50 like famous iconic tshuvos, and that's one of them. So if that's in the show's notes, then, you know.
Absolutely. So Rabbi Fisher has done a lot of translating for Pini Halacha, as you mentioned in your bio, the English Pini Halacha, and also many of the Shalos tshuvos that can be found on Sefaria. So God willing, we'll link this tshuva in the show notes. And Shkayach for all that you're doing to be Marbitz Torah and making it accessible for all of Klal Yisrael.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? Please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.